Psychology at Work. A podcast series exploring the work of professionals in the mental health care field, developed by the Psychology Department at Western Connecticut State University. Hello, this is your host, Shane Murphy, and today we are interviewing Dr. Joseph Conrad, who is a substance abuse treatment specialist working at the Counseling Centers of Connecticut. Well, Joseph, thank you so much for coming in
pleasure.
Today. Appreciate it. And Joseph was late because of a crisis situation. So that's perfect. I mean, this interview series is about what psychologists do. So what happened today?
Well, this particular situation involved a patient being referred to us by the courts. Upon evaluation, it became very clear to us that he was responding to some rather significant acute symptomatology, where the content and the quality of the things that he was saying, there was both initially a bit of guardedness to suspiciousness to even, you know, elements of paranoia. He also had what we refer to as some ideas of reference. He also, unfortunately, began to disclose some other thoughts that he was harboring, both about wanting to exact harm on various people. So obviously, my clinician very appropriately stops that, goes to get support. I come in, I get involved, do a little bit more fact-finding. It's pretty clear that he was experiencing some pretty significant psychotic symptoms. So at that point, I'm talking to him about safety. I'm talking about other ideas he might be harboring. And the short of it was, in that crisis situation, it's really to maintain the safety of the patient, but also to get him the correct level of care. So what I always say to my staff, I pull the trigger, I have my support. I'm very well connected to my community where my clinic is in Waterbury. So I reach out to EMS. They always have a police officer that responds. I actually tell the individual I'm concerned about him. I'm concerned about his welfare, that we really want to provide him the right kind of treatment at this time. And he said, well, what does that mean? I said, well, I want you to go see my pal over at the hospital. And he said, well, what's going to happen? He said, well, they're just going to ask you more questions, and we're going to make sure that you're okay, and then we can just go from there. And then the last thing he says, well, after all that, can I come back? And I said, absolutely. So basically, what happens at that point is we just contain, wait for EMS. I have command at that point. When EMS arrives with police, I then fill them in. I then say, are you prepared to take over command? They take command. I then escorted the gentleman to the ambulance, and he gets in the ambulance, and they go on their way.
Wow. So, just another day at the office.
Right. And I'll tell you another story very quickly about that. So 3 weeks ago, and if anyone's taken my classes, you know, sort of, or know about me, one of the principal places I work is a comprehensive ambulatory behavioral health setting, and that's just a fancy word for, you know, we provide outpatient mental health or behavioral health and substance use disorder services to the greater Waterbury area. Obviously, I'm on the front line of treating the opioid epidemic in the state of Connecticut, nationally and internationally as well. Actually, I'm giving a paper in Baltimore about this. And you've all heard about Narcan, life-saving, so on. So I'm also working, and I have right now, so you understand the number of souls that we're taking care of. Right now I have 900 folks that come to my clinic. And in any event, so one of my patients I'm working with, she actually just started treating with us. And so the short of it was, she comes to clinic, she actually, one of the principal medicines we use is methadone. We also use Suboxone. In this case, this gal was coming in to see her counselor, to receive a dose of medicine. And the short of this was, her boyfriend was in the car. Her boyfriend just got out of prison up in Enfield. And what they do is, he gets out of prison, he gets on a bus. This bus goes down to New Haven. They let them all out there, and then they have to get another bus, and then they go to their respective towns.
You can't walk away from certain facilities.
It's amazing. In any event, so I see this gal coming in and talking to her counselor, and then I, you know, just observing her, and then she immediately turns around and runs to the car, opens the car and then runs back yelling and screaming. My boyfriend's overdosing. My boyfriend's dying. So obviously I see all this. Immediately, again, it's one of these things where we take command. So I get my medical team. We go out there. He's unresponsive. A very, very weak pulse. So obviously he was in acute, he was experiencing an acute overdose. So we have our Narcan kit. And then in that instance, you know, we have to whack him with Narcan. We're doing, obviously we're taking vitals. Still very weak pulse, still unresponsive. We then have to go through a protocol. We wait 60 seconds. We hit him again. And then waited 30 seconds, then did 30 seconds of rescue breathing, and he woke up. And he's looking right at me. So that just gives you a sense of the work I do on every day. So in any event, the same kind of thing, EMS comes over, police are there. In any these circumstances, fire department also comes. So it was quite a scene. However, he was awake. He wasn't that alert. We're able to take him to hospital. But this is the thing about this story. So it's the funny thing is, he was coming from prison to come to us to do an intake to begin treatment with us. And in between coming out of prison to getting to his girlfriend, he picked up. And then, you know, obviously did this. So we saved his life. This was at 1 p.m. He then had two other instances in the next 24 hours where police had to respond to him two more times. In any event, he's with us now. He's in treatment with us now. And we're continuing.
He's lucky to be alive.
Lucky to be alive. But every time he sees me, he says, "You're that guy. I remember you." I said, "Yeah. I'm glad to see you."
So. You were the first face
right.
I saw when
exactly,
I came out
right.
of it.
Exactly, right.
Wow.
Right.
Well, very intense. Mm-hmm. Let's go back a little bit.
Sure.
Where did you first get interested in mental health issues? Was it as an undergraduate? Was
I can even tell you earlier than that. I actually grew up in the Midwest. I was born in Indiana. I have to say that. I'm a Hoosier.
Right.
But I love Duke University. Make no mistake. That said, because I know it's March Madness. I grew up in Wisconsin, and it was my senior year in high school where I took several psychology classes, and it piqued my interest, and from that moment forward, I never looked back. So then I applied to the University of Portland, and I went to the Pacific Northwest, which is a sister school of Notre Dame, and the reason I picked that university was, and they had a very robust psychology department, but I picked that as my major even before I got there. But I also was afforded to go a year abroad. And so I lived in Salzburg, Austria for my sophomore year and was there for about a year and a half and was affiliated with the University of Salzburg. And that provided me, and I purposely wanted to do that so I could get a much broader worldview and have that experience. And so I finished my undergrad at University of Portland. And then I came back to Wisconsin, and before I was figuring out what I wanted to do, I knew I wanted to go on, and I took a job working in a residential facility working with the chronically mentally ill in a group home setting. And I did that for a year and a half. And then in between that, working with those folks and getting that experience, I then applied to the University of Duquesne, or Duquesne University, which is in Pittsburgh. I purposely picked that university because of its particular focus on the way they taught clinical psychology. And they taught it in a much more European style, and it was founded on phenomenology, which is a particular philosophical position. And I also wanted to really develop my skills of critical thinking and evaluation prior to then figuring out if I wanted to, which, you know, way I was going to go in terms of, I knew then that I wanted to also go and get my doctorate in clinical psychology. But the thing for me was do I want to go a traditional PhD route or are there other routes? And so from my experience at Duquesne University, I then chose to go the PsyD route. So I have a PsyD, a practitioner's doctorate. And I went to the Illinois School of Professional Psychology, which is now Argus University. And principally there to be able to utilize that critical thinking foundation and then to be exposed to the widest array of orientations and positions in clinical psychology. And obviously a very rigorous, very comprehensive program. I also had the opportunity when I was there, I was both a teaching assistant and a research assistant. And that allowed me to be affiliated with Northwestern Memorial Hospital. So I also worked there. which then I had opportunity to interface with professors from Northwestern University. And then I did some work at the Sonia Shankman Orthogenic School, which is affiliated with the University of Chicago. And that was a residential school for children from first to 12th grade that presented with very, very severe behavioral conditions, sometimes consistent with what we would call childhood schizophrenia and things like that. And although don't use those diagnoses, these were children that were very troubled. And actually, the orthogenic school was founded by Bruno Bettelheim. Mm. If you know who Bruno Bettelheim was, or he was part of Freud's inner circle. And so I also had opportunity to work with those folks. And one of my most important mentors was the head of research there, Dr. Patrick Zimmerman. He was actually one of the the head of my dissertation committee.
That's interesting. We talked a couple of weeks ago about the Boulder model. It was talked about in the textbook. Mm. So what was your experience of that in a PsyD program? You know, and do you think that, because we had a debate about that, do we have to be both a scientist and a practitioner trained to be a good clinical doctoral level psychologist?
I would say, in my experience, both sides of the equation are important. And I can tell you from my experience, picking a PsyD program, and make no mistake, it was just as rigorous on the clinical side as it was on the scientific side. They held you to a high standard to really make sure that you understood the science and not just the practice, and then how you apply that. The other thing is that you had ample opportunity to practice that which you're being trained in, so there were multiple practicums that we had to go through, both psychotherapy and both assessment. And then, leading up to finishing your classwork and then doing your pre-doctoral internship, then your postdoc and your fellowship and so on. And I can say my training was very well-rounded, and I'm just as familiar with the empirical scientific side of understanding our science and how we apply that information to our work. But also, someone talked about the importance of psychotherapy and the art and the practice and science of psychotherapy and really what makes a good psychotherapist. And even before sort of knowing your techniques, all the different permutations, it's engagement skills, those capacities to reach people empathically and to remain objective and to, regardless of where that person is, start what they are, but be able to demonstrate that in the most authentic and genuine way. And from my program, that was something that we were able to practice over and over and over. So I know it's a long-winded way to sort of answer your question, but I really wanted to have a balance of both sides. So I could obviously keep up with the research, keep up with the empiricism, really be on, because what's the half-life of a psychiatric fact these days? 3.5, maybe 4 years. What does that mean? It's that our knowledge base in this science continually evolves and continually changes and it's updated. I have to digress. Someone mentioned, psychopharmacology. We know that efficacy in general is only 40%, but why is that? Because as much as we understand genomic expression, we don't have it all figured out. And it can be effective, but there are other things going on. And that's helped our science. And so we, as practitioners, have to be very up on that. And so you have to be able to know how you read scientific journals and really to, in some ways, evaluate the research and evaluate the conclusions that are there.
So how is that possible? Because it must be such a challenge for a clinician to be able to sort of stay up with the latest things. What helps you with that? Is it going to conferences? Is it doing a workshop? Is it webinars nowadays with technology?
Conferences. Part of what we do, because actually my primary employer is Connecticut Counseling Centers, Inc. But I can tell you, 10 years ago, Dr. Murphy's colleague, Dr. Gallucci, called me out of the blue, which was a great phone call, and asked me if I would be interested in teaching a course. And my first course that I taught 10 years ago here was the psychology of women. And then it just took off from there. So part of my evolution and my continued evolution development as a clinician and as a practitioner has been this experience as well.
That's great.
Because being in the classroom and working with students, the professor has to make sure that they are always updating their knowledge base and making sure that they are really, in terms of whatever the course is, especially in the discipline of psychology, that the information we're giving you is not only correct, but it's also can be, applied. And then obviously, for my purposes, that's not only helped me as a practicing clinician, but it's also made me a better teacher. The other thing that I do is, for example, I mentioned that I'm going to deliver a paper at our international conference in Baltimore. So my chief medical officer and I, he is the vice president of the American Society of Addiction Medicine. And he and I worked together for 9 years. And so I've also been, afforded this opportunity to work in a multidisciplinary setting. So I work with primary care, I work with internal medicine, I work with nursing, not just behavioral health clinicians. And I have a whole array of behavioral health clinicians that I work with, from counselors to psychologists to clinical social workers, all licensed at credentialed at different levels. But I'm also in this very unique setting with all these different disciplines that are represented. And I actually am the one principally responsible for running that show. So I have to be able to interface with medicine and understand where they're coming from, and understand their side of the discipline. And also psychiatry is represented. The psychiatrist that works with me, she's been with our clinic now for 25 years. And it's interesting, and she's very conservative about intervening pharmacologically, but when we have to, we will. And so it's also understanding that side of the equation and then being able to interface with those folks. And then at the end of the day, it's us being able to provide the highest level quality of care for the patients that we're tasked to serve, and to indeed, in some ways, assist in enhancing their quality of life, whatever that might be. And for some of our folks, it's not just day by day, it's minute by minute, hour by hour, and then we build from there.
So I think your emphasis on a team approach is very valuable, and that's one thing I hear from my colleagues all the time, is that it's more and more of a team approach. Nobody can, there's just not enough expertise in an individual to be able to deal with the complicated situations. I also get the feedback that psychology, clinical psychology, is moving more towards integration with primary care. Is that your experience also?
Indeed, and with the advent of the Affordable Care Act and moving towards this medical home model, part of a subpart of that is actually developing these behavioral health home types of protocols. And and to answer, it's an interesting type of thing. The front line, where a lot of these folks first begin to seek care for, say, a behavioral health disturbance, is primary care, is with their PCPs. And in part, they're trying to understand that. And that's actually a really good point of interface for us. And so it is absolutely true that clinical psychology as a whole is making inroads into primary care, and as well as urgent care. I mean, I have affiliations with Waterbury Hospital, St. Mary's Hospital, and then an array of community providers, and it extends beyond just our internal multidisciplinary team, but I work with all these others. Because what do we know about behavioral health? So does go with someone struggling with, say, a major depressive disorder or a substance use disorder or an anxiety disorder. The comorbidity that we see with them also developing chronic medical conditions or acute medical conditions is you have concordance rates of 0.75, 0.8. So clinical psychology is going to play a pivotal role in understanding that and then being able to be part of that team to intervene.
You mentioned Dr. Gallucci, who was the chair of the department at the time. He contacted Dr. Conrad and has also been pivotal in developing our substance abuse program. And then you mentioned the heroin epidemic in Connecticut and indeed the country, really, right. New England. And Dr. Gallucci and I have been working on the development of a fifth-year master's program proposal for Western Connecticut State University.
Excellent.
So we hope that the Board of Regents will consider it, where our students could finish their 4 years, stay on for the summer, and then an extra year and get a master's degree to become a licensed drug and alcohol abuse counselor.
No, that's great.
Yeah.
Because we need it.
I know, it's sad, but it just seems like it's getting worse instead of better. Yeah.
Absolutely.
When you look back, what one or two things did you take from your clinical training as a graduate student that has been most helpful to you in your actual practice?
Just how rigorous the program was in and of itself. And from doing my evaluations to treating folks, in some ways it just was ingrained in us to not leave any stone unturned. And the other thing too is, from an evaluative point of view as well as from a psychotherapy point of view, we never take the position that we know what our patients are going through. We're always open to the possibility to help them best understand what their suffering is about. And I say that, and it's not a knock on clinicians, but sometimes we can become complacent in where we think that we know, or that, oh yeah, so this is this and this, and so it must be that. And we tend to speed ourselves up, and I tend to always want to slow it down so that we can get a much better, more comprehensive understanding of what's going on with our folks, and not just assume. And you know, someone said that here, for example, and again, it's not a knock on any one clinician, but you cannot see a child for 15 minutes, listen to some vague complaints from parents, and then, you know, basically conclude from that that this child has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. It's just not possible. However, we know that the way the healthcare system is strained, that still tends to happen. And the other side of that is when you're dealing with, and actually also to sort of expand this, just to give you a sense of the populations I've worked with. I've worked with children as young as five, I've worked with adolescents, I've worked with families, I've worked with adults, and I've worked with geriatric populations in all different settings. Inpatient, outpatient, long-term, residential, now ambulatory. And so in actually the first part of my career, I had an opportunity to work mostly with kids and their families. Young children, and did family psychotherapy, individual psychotherapy, group psychotherapy, and so on. And one of the things that we learned, and one of the things I learned, and one of the things using for my training, was indeed, we don't just sort of dive in and assume that we know what's going on, because we understand that children's developmental trajectory is so explosive, and there's lots of things going on and lots of things that we need to consider before we render a particular discrete diagnosis. And then especially if we make that leap to intervene chemically, we need to do so with diligence. And I always tell this statistic, I mean, before, there are that's a reason why some of the psychotropics you use have black labels on them now. Cannot use them with kids, because a couple years ago we had 59 fatalities, children being treated with Zyprexa and other types of very powerful medication. And so there's also that side of it. And by the way, in terms of my training and then obviously my trajectory and needing to stay up on you know, the field and so on, a couple of the other things, the roles I play in my organization, not only do I run one of the biggest, busiest clinics, I'm also the chief privacy officer. And I also do all the forensic investigations. So what does that mean? Because we have patients that we can treat for years. We have, and unlike, you know, it's interesting. In this managed care environment, we have this hybrid program where we'll have patients that are with us for maybe 1, 2, 5, 10, 15 years. That said, we see the impact of treated and untreated behavioral health conditions and how they can impact the individual physiologically. And so invariably, there's a risk that comes with managing these folks. And so there's a whole risk management hat that I have to wear. But any time something untoward happens to any of my patients on my service, meaning to say there's a fatality, I'm the one that has to investigate what happened. And it's not to find fault with us, but it's part of the regulations and the rules that I have to follow based upon the services we provide. Sure. And I can tell you, in the last 3 months, I've had more fatalities, and not due to anything that we're doing, just because of the other chronic medical conditions these folks were dealing with, than I have in the last 9 years. Wow. And so it just shows the shit. We know that we have an aging population too that needs treatment, and we're seeing some of these other types of, you know, phenomena show itself.
In the last 10 minutes, I turn it over to the class and ask them for questions. So we'll do that and just introduce yourself when you ask the question.
Hi, I'm Rodrigo. So I was wondering, do you have like medical training to administer drugs such as like Narcan?
You have to be, well, you get certified. It's a very simple protocol. You can take, it's basically an hour training, and then you have the kit, and then, you know, you, and the laws in the state of Connecticut have changed, so then in the case that you have to do that, that was part of the issue, because what happens, more times than not, these folks don't use alone. They always use with at least one other person, and that, well, what would happen? The other person would see the other one, you know, going, and they would take off. And then, so we're off to the races. But in terms of answer your question, it's a very simple thing to get certified and then know how to deliver it, and then you can be able to do that. Oh, sorry. Oh, yeah.
Hi, Dr. Conner, Barbara Thomas. I have a question. I am starting the master's program here for licensed mental health counselor.
Mm-hmm.
So what the
soldiers PTSD,
mm-hmm. who we know most substance is from. Is when you want, I know it's the PSYD, but is there a separate training besides the master's program you want to do for substance abuse?
Well, as Dr. Murphy is saying, substance use disorder treatment, which is also part, you know, clinical psychologists are trained to treat all of these, but for, say, at the master's level, if you have an interest in treating, say, a particular population that, you know, there's a high prevalence of substance use disorders, then there's additional training that you would take in addition to, you know, your program. And it meets a certain state standard, so that not only when you're finished with your program and you get your supervision hours in, you would get your LPC as well as your LADC. And that's, you know, the difference there.
And those are state certifications.
Those are state certifications, right. But just so I want to finish that. To treat that population effectively, you absolutely have to understand the trajectory of not just post-traumatic stress disorder, but how substance use disorders do, play a huge part in that. And then there are additional things that go on for these folks that you also have to be savvy for, but especially the substance use disorders.
Hey, I'm Jake.
Hey,
Jake. Going off of Rodrigo's question, do you see patients overdosing more on opiates now that Narcan is available in homes, or do you think it has helped at all, or do you not see?
Well, we know that with the advent of the national release of Narcan and then SAMHSA and CSAT and the DEA providing, you know, guidelines around using that, I wouldn't say it has gone up. More of our problem is this. Despite all of our supposed intervention in Afghanistan, we have a bumper crop. And not only is it a bumper crop, but it's high quality, high quality. So we have an issue of purity, because this is the other cool thing that I do. I work with consumer protection and I work with interdiction. And what I mean by that, I also, because of we actually dispense certain types of medications, I work with the DEA. So I have it in this unique, it's just very strange, in this unique setting. I work with these federal officials. I have DEA come and see me every so often. I work with interdiction in the state of Connecticut. And basically what happens, we're following the opioid epidemic. And in fact, in 2 weeks, I'm doing town meeting with the commissioner, with my mayor of Waterbury and some other folks in Naugatuck talk about this very thing. But the answer to the question is, it's not that it's going up, it's the fact that the purity of the heroin has gone up and it's being cut with fentanyl. That is the deadly combination. And unfortunately, everybody that's picking this stuff up, they don't know. But we do know that over the last 3 months, fentanyl production has outpaced marijuana coming across the border. Just to give you a sense of the scale of the problem.
Is that, though, partially related to the fact that now oftentimes that cannabis is produced in the country as opposed to...
No, it still was a cash crop for them, but you have to understand it's because heroin is so cheap. And then basically you can spread out how much heroin that you put in each bundle or each bag, and then you cut it with something like fentanyl. And, you know, then these folks are off to the races.
Fentanyl isn't something that is easily acquired, I
thought. Oh, well, you get these guys are junior chemists.
So
you get one patch of fentanyl. There's a way you freeze it, you boil it down, and then you can pick it apart. You can see what the compounds are, and you can make it.
Wow.
And it's troubling, but that's just the reality.
Yeah. I've also heard that in some cases, people have been lacing other drugs with heroin to get.
But that's yeah.
To get the younger populations addicted.
Well, more times than not, to answer your question, more of what we know, and this is this interesting thing. So we have in the state of Connecticut, as well as other places, called this thing called PMP, or the Connecticut PMP, and that's the Prescription Monitoring Program. And we've now required every physician in the state of Connecticut, as well as other professionals, they have to check the PMP before they dispense a certain class of medication. So if I know that I've already given you a 30-day supply of Xanax, You're not going to come to Dr. Murphy and say, oh, Dr. Murphy, I need Xanax. He would need to check the PMP to make sure that you haven't received this and so forth. So, but, and we do that with prescription painkillers. More of the younger population, where it sort of brings them to heroin, is the fact that they've become dependent based upon the painkillers, not what they're putting in the heroin. Right, Vicodin and so on.
Yeah.
And that a lot of my, and it's interesting, 10 years ago, the cohort class in general, when we're talking about a primary opioid dependence, was 25 to 35. Now we're seeing that shift younger and younger and younger. So now I have a cohort group of patients that are from 18 to 22, 23, and that requires a different intervention strategy than what we would do with older adults. We typically, and so what does that mean? That we have to have folks that are much more skilled on that side of the equation to understanding where these folks are developmentally and psychologically so that we can intervene effectively. But to answer your question, it's not heroin per se what they're putting in, it's where they got started. All of my young kids that are with me for 90% of the time got injured, or a friend gave me this, or it was in my mom's medicine cabinet, or my dad's medicine cabinet, or it's at grandma and grandpa's house, or it's over here. And that's how I started. And that's why, we turn that spigot off. This is really the other thing. It's sort of like stealing from Peter to get Paul high. So we turn that spigot off. So we're saying you can't prescribe these very powerful opiates, these analgesics, Oxycontin, Vicodin, fentanyl, and so on. So you turn that spigot off, what happens? Then the demand shifts. And so now you see, and it's just word to the wise. I mean, obviously you've heard everything, but the cost is very cheap. Heroin is very cheap, very readily available.
All right, one last question.
Yeah.
Before you mentioned that you worked in a school of first graders to 12th graders, and you see these kids experiencing abnormal behavioral symptoms. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering, what do those behavioral symptoms consist of, and what was being done to treat those symptoms at the time?
Well, before we start with any child, it requires a comprehensive evaluation. So, and I'll just give you a very, and what do you mean by that? So there is this unique thing that happens neuropsychologically, and it's called immature proprioceptive syndrome. And basically what it means is that some children they're not as efficient at being able to orient themselves in a four-dimensional space. And these are folks that aren't so good with their boundaries, and they sort of bump into stuff, and they fall up the stairs, and they look fidgety, and they don't look like they're paying attention, and they don't concentrate. What does that sound like? Yeah. But it's not that. And so it requires a very thorough and comprehensive evaluation first. And then once we have a better sense of what's going on, and I mean thorough, we're working with, that's where pediatric psychologists come in, that's our primary care, and then we're evaluating that child comprehensively from a primary care perspective, from a neurological perspective, from the developmental perspective, and a psychological perspective. So, and we're assessing them objectively as well as subjectively, and then based upon the finding of that, we'll determine how we understand what's going on vis-a-vis their behavior. And then the other side of that is first and foremost, we want to attempt to understand what that child's world is like. And then based upon how they present, we'll determine how we evaluate and then determine how we design the intervention strategies before we go forward.
So what was causing those symptoms?
Well, again, there's not any one thing. You have to, when we're talking about especially childhood psychopathology, we still have to do that rubric. So we look at the environment. We look at genomic expression. We look at heritability. We look at family. We look at all of these different, facets to this child's life. We look at things, people have taken some of my classes, they come out of there understanding how important attachment theory is to understanding psychological development. And so we also evaluate them from that point of view. And so many times you're saying, what sort of creates that? It's a multitude of factors. And again, it's not enough. It's never enough to just say, oh, this child has X or this child has Y. Because diagnostically we have to do that, but does that tell you anything per se? No more what tells you is sort of what does that mean in terms of how they then approach various situations. And then as we observe that and analyze that, and then, you know, better understand that, then we, you know, can chart a course of action. And then what does that mean? So then we're going to intervene in every one of those arenas.
All right, great. Let's thank Dr. Conrad.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much.